Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back for our second big hour of our big open forum Thursday show. Jimmy Akin here with us both hours. Lots of calls on the line, but if you'd like to call, if you have a question about the Catholic faith, if you have a question about moral issues, if you have a question about religion in general or a philosophical question, we welcome them all during open forum. And if you are not a Catholic and so you think you are excluded, you are mistaken. You're welcome. We're happy to have anybody call with a question. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. As I said, Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Jimmy is the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and you can get that book and many others at 30% off right now at shop.catholic.com, and you should. This is a good book to have. I like A Daily Defense because 365 days plus one is a lot.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
you cover a lot of topics.
That's actually a New Year's resolution I would get behind, is like read from A Daily Defense every day.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. You don't have to start on January 1st and go through the year, but why not?
Yeah.
We're so close.
And you can even binge read if you want to get ahead. That's totally fine.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
At least a page a day, that's a manageable, achievable goal, like we were talking about in the previous hour. By the way, during the break, you were saying this is the last hour. So, like, the end of the world is about to
happen? This is the world will end after this hour of Catholic Answers. No, actually, that's not true.
It's just the last hour we're going to be
live on the radio this year. That's
right. Well, Happy New Year to you and to all of the listeners then.
Oh, thank you, Jimmy. And Happy New Year to you. I'm not a big one for celebrating New Year's Eve, though. Are you a big one for celebrating?
I'm a big one for going to sleep.
Yeah.
I know when I was a kid, it was like, okay, stay up to midnight. Well, if I stay up to midnight now, I pay for it the next day.
Right. And I don't know. A lot of cities nowadays, though, have these big first night celebrations and people out in the street with all kinds of stuff. It's going to be so cold in the Northeast.
They call them that, first night?
That's what they call it in Boston. I don't
really
know what they call it in other places.
You say that in Latin, it means something completely different.
Oh, that's a
prima nocta.
That's a practice.
Or
at least an alleged practice.
Did it happen? Alleged practice.
It wasn't
real. No one would really stand for that in real life. Yeah.
No, and certainly Mel Gibson wouldn't stand for it.
No.
That's what the trouble started there.
In Braveheart?
In Braveheart, yeah. You're going to have to look that one up for yourselves, kids. We're not going to go into that anymore, but we will go to this call. Anonymous, in an anonymous location, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please. I'm sorry. Anonymous just dropped.
Oh, no.
That could well have been me. Anonymous, if that was me, just call back.
Just to handle Anonymous's question in case he's not able to, why don't we address it real quick? Anonymous, according to the call screening we have, Anonymous said, in my last confession, I told my confessor that I've been going to confession almost daily since I'm afraid I'm doing something wrong in the eyes of God. He told me that I may have scrupulosity, so I was wondering if Jimmy had any advice for me. Well, if you feel compelled to go to confession that frequently, there is a good chance that you may have scrupulosity, unless you're doing something, unless you're every day, deliberately and knowingly
turning your back on God,
and committing a mortal sin, then that impulse of thinking you need to go to confession in this way is a really good indicator of scrupulosity. And there are various helps. I know we here at Catholic.com, we have carried some books on scrupulosity. I'm not sure what we have in the store at the moment. Understanding Scrupulosity was one book that dealt with a subject that I know we carried. So you could check shop.catholic.com for that. We also at forums.catholic.com, if you type in scrupulosity there, you'll find some threads dealing with it. Also, there's a group that is connected with Liguri Publications called Scrupulous Anonymous, and it's a support group for scrupulous people. They have their own website, and they have a newsletter that they would publish, and that the archives of it are there online. And so I would definitely also check out Scrupulous Anonymous.
I'm sorry that I dropped you anonymous, but maybe you can go ahead and give us a call back if you like.
Don't get scrupulous. It may not have been you. It might have been a phone problem, or anonymous may not have been able to wait any longer, any number of things.
That's a good point. I'll try not to be scrupulous about the call about scrupulosity. 888-31-TRUTH is our number, 888-318-7884. Nicole in Riverside, California, listening to EWTN on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Hi, Nicole. Nope. Okay, Nicole, I'm not going to hang up on you. I'll come back to you in a minute, see if you're there when I get back. But in the meantime, we'll go to Maureen in Raymond, Maine, listening on the Presence Radio. Maureen, your question for Jimmy Akin. Hi, Maureen. This doesn't seem
so
possible.
Maybe there's
a phone problem.
Well, maybe. But one thing that people sometimes do when they're on the line is they start listening on speakerphone or something. And that means they're not ready when we answer the call because there can be a lag. Yeah. It's partly light speed delay, but it's other factors as well. There can be a lag between what you're hearing on the radio and what's happening live. Yeah. So it's important once you're on the line, stay listening to your phone. Don't put us on speaker. Don't listen to the radio. And that way you'll be ready to go when we are able to get to your call.
Light speed lag?
Yeah.
That's a thing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally.
Really? I've never had light speed lag.
You may have known it.
Okay, it goes by so fast you might not even know you have
it. But that's like why if you're talking to, you know, people on other parts of the planet, it takes a while because information is bounded by the speed of light. And so it takes a while for the electrical signals that carry the information over a phone line or a computer line to bounce up to satellites and bounce down to other places and get routed through the fiber optics, which have – because speed of light changes in glass compared to a vacuum. And so light speed delay is something that can affect human communications.
What are you, the child of college professors or something?
yeah.
Let's try Bennett in New York City, New York, listening on 88.7 FM. If you're not there, Bennett, I'm going to cry on the air. Are you there?
Yes. Hello.
Thank you for saving me from crying. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Well, I was recently surprised to see in the catechism, it says that Jesus has two souls.
Where are you reading that? What passage?
I don't have it on me at the moment.
Okay. It's always important to have stuff like that because it enables us to check the exact wording and clarify any misapprehension. But why don't you go ahead with your question, and then I'll do what I can to answer it.
Well, I wondered if you had heard of it. The only thing I could kind of think of was that he was always the Son of God, but he was not always the Son of Mary.
Yeah.
The explanation, they kind of, you know, as I understood it, Jesus left heaven to come to earth, but it seems to be saying in the catechism that he was simultaneously in heaven and it was just, you know, it really threw me off.
Okay, so let's do what we can to clarify this. Jesus, in his divine nature, so when we're thinking about Jesus as God, he has the attributes of God. And that means, among other things, he's outside of space and time. He's not extended in space and time the way a physical body is. And because he always has a divine nature, his divine nature is always there in eternity and thus always in heaven in that sense. At the same time, though, he became incarnate at a specific point in time. When he was conceived in Mary's womb, either in the year 4 or 3 BC by our reckoning. And from that point forward, all the way to today, he has, in addition to his divine nature in eternity, he has a human nature. To help us visualize that, the New Testament does talk about him coming down from heaven and then going back to heaven. But you have to be careful about what kind of heaven are we talking about. If we're talking about the ultimate heaven outside of space and time where God fundamentally is, he's always there because as God, he can't leave that. It wouldn't be possible for him to leave a state where there is no time. If you're ever in a state where there is no time, there's no time for you to then leave it. So he's always present in eternity in his divine nature. He then took on a human nature and inside of history and lived here on earth for a time. And then when he ascended into heaven, that's a different kind of heaven. It's the kind of heaven where souls and angels and other departed saints who may still have their bodies are. It's not the timeless eternity heaven. It's a different heaven. That's something we talked about in the previous hour, how the Bible and certain other early documents conceptualizes there being multiple different heavens with God dwelling in the highest heaven.
Right.
So that's kind of an explanation for how Jesus came to have his human nature in the realm of time, even though his divine nature resides in the realm of eternity outside of time. In terms of his soul, well, he doesn't have two souls. I suspect that you have perhaps misunderstood something the Catechism says. If we had the exact passage, I could clarify. I could clarify it exactly, but I suspect it was one of two things that you may have read. The first one is, since God is spirit, Jesus has a divine spirit. Humans, though, also have spirits as part of human nature. They have finite spirits. And so in addition to his infinite divine spirit, when he took on human nature, Jesus acquired a finite human spirit in addition. We don't use the word soul, though, for the divine spirit. So that's why we don't say Jesus has two souls. You could say he has two spirits, a divine spirit and a human spirit. And the word soul is sometimes used as another way of referring to a human spirit, but it's not used to refer to angelic, to other kinds of spirits, like angelic spirits. We don't say angels or souls. We say they're spirits. And it's not how we refer to the divine spirit. So that's part of it. The other thing you might have read that could play a role here is Christ's will, because Christ does have two wills. Since he has a divine mind as part of his divine nature, he has a divine will. And since he has a human mind, a human intellect as part of his human nature, he also has a human will. And so it's accurate to say that Jesus has two wills. They're never in conflict with each other. He's not schizophrenic or anything like that. His two wills always function frictionlessly with respect to each other. They're always in agreement, but they are two wills because he has these two natures. And that was a point of theological controversy at one point in the church's history. There were a group of Christians known as monothelites. From Greek, mono means one, thelema means will, and they thought Jesus only had one will. But the church pointed out, no, since he has a complete divine nature, he's fully God, and since he has a complete human nature, he's fully man, he must have two wills. And so the correct position is not monothelitism, but diothelitism, duo meaning two, thelema meaning will. So Jesus has two wills. So you can say he has two spirits or two wills, but we don't say he has two souls.
Bennett, thanks very much for that call, and thanks for being on the line when we went to you. Man, when you start talking about mind and spirit and all that, words almost kind of break down. It's very hard for us to have images of things.
And they're used, even these terms like soul and spirit and body, they all get used different ways. They're not
right.
And that complicates the question. Sometimes we use the word soul as a reference to the whole human being. I mean, we do that in English. If a ship goes down and 50 souls were lost, but they also do that in Scripture. So you see, like in Genesis 2, where God breathes into Adam's nostrils, and so man became a living soul, is what it says in Hebrew.
Right. I'm of two minds on that. Not really. I'm just kidding. I'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
We're here for you. Give us a call today on Catholic Answers Live.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Open forum on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, and Katie in Belleville, Illinois, listening on 92.7 FM. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, Katie.
Hi there. All right. I'm very excited to ask this, but also a little nervous, so please bear with me on
behalf
of lots of women who are dying to know the answer to this.
No problem.
Okay. So this is kind of tied to the NSP marital relations question from a few minutes ago.
Okay.
So my husband and I have been very faithfully practicing NFP. We've been married a couple of years, and I wanted to ask about the understanding of, okay, so when women are, you know, going through their fertile period, that is probably the time they're most interested in relations with their spouse. And so much so that a lot of us can almost guarantee that the first morning we notice hubby looking really good in his work pants. Oh, well, I bet I go in and I do my little test and, oh, I'm fertile. So no fun for about 9 days. And then by the time that's over and, you know, husband's drive has been pretty consistent every single day forever, you know, the entire life of our marriage. Then it's time to engage in the marital embrace. And by that time, you know, I'm kind of like, oh, okay, well, you know, I'm going to do this. I love you, of course. It's a sacramental, important part of our marriage. But he can tell I'm kind of, you know, I'm doing it to be nice, and I love him. But he kind of disappoints him that it's not, I'm not matching the drive level. So basically, ever since we've been married, we haven't both been really into it, and it bothers him a lot. And, you know, I'm like, you know, it's okay, it's penance and whatever, and I try to chalk it up to all this other stuff. I mean, not to say, like, who wouldn't love to be able to do that, but I try to be positive. I certainly don't want him to feel bad, but it just bothers him. And, and I'm just wondering, have you ever, I can't find anything. I mean, I guess it's because it's probably a difficult topic. A lot of church leaders are male. A lot of them don't get married. So until someone like you, you know, or other theologians maybe come along that are accessible to the public, I don't think it gets talked about a whole lot. And I'm just wondering,
your situation is not unique. Your situation is not unique, not in the least. This is very common. There are, you know, the fundamental purpose of sex is to get us to procreate as a species. I mean, that's why we have it. In humans, it also has this additional function of bonding and helping the spouses stay together, which is both to their benefit and the benefit of the offspring. I mean, even if you don't have children, the fact that the spouses are bonded together, they both live longer lives as a result because they're cooperating. Other species, it doesn't have this bonding function. You know, they just, they engage in their equivalent of the marital act, and then they go their own ways, and procreation is the only function it plays for them. But for us, it does play this additional function. However, as we mentioned, the way God's designed it for our species, women are only fertile during certain periods, and during those times, the fundamental purpose of reproduction of sex is going to assert itself in the form of additional interest on the part of the woman, because that's its ultimate, most basic purpose is reproduction. So it's natural that women have more interest in the marital act during those times when they're fertile and have less interest in other times. Contrary to the way other species are, though, females are still sexually receptive during those times, even if they're not as aggressively interested in having sex. And so there's this kind of tension that's caused by the way the two sexes operate that happens in marriage, where when a woman is most interested, if it's not the right time for her to have a child or to risk having a child, then she needs to practice some self-denial, as does her husband. On the other hand, husbands' sexual drives are much more constant because they're not tied to a monthly cycle in the same way. And so your kind of situation is one that comes up. And I just want to praise you, Katie, for doing your best to help your husband out in these times, even if your own interest level is not as great, during the times when you are bonding as spouses in this way. At least you're doing that, and that's important. And it's something it's not the greatest term, but there's a term that's been used in recent years in like marital counseling and stuff for this kind of bonding. It's sometimes called maintenance sex, to just help maintain the relationship, help things keep on an even keel so that it feels like you are continuing to bond in this way. And that's very important, especially for men, because they have this constant sexual drive, even if they need to practice self-denial, just like women do at certain points. So I want to praise you for that. That's great. In terms of the difficulty your husband is encountering, I can think of a couple of things that might help. One of them is, now you mentioned the word penance in how you can sometimes think of it. I would encourage a more positive way of framing it. Instead of saying it's like accepting something as a penance, I would say it's something I want to do because I love you. And I'd make sure I don't use the word penance, because that could make him feel guilty if he feels like he's imposing on you in that way. I would also propose a kind of reverse situation as a way of helping him understand it, because there are oftentimes, I mean, marriage is a give and take, and each spouse in a successful, healthy marriage is going to need to do things at various times to please the other spouse. This is something St. Paul talks about, and he actually talks about it in the context of sex. He says that when you get married, your body is not exclusively your own anymore. A husband has rights to his wife's body. The wife has rights to her husband's body. And so you shouldn't be denying each other except for a mutually agreed upon time. And so that means for both sexes, there can be times where a spouse says, I need this right now. Now, just given the way our species works, much of the time that's going to be the man saying, I need it. But it can also happen with the reverse. But even if it's not sex, men need to do things that they're not necessarily particularly interested in order to please their wives. There are lots of those. LA?
No, ballet.
Ballet. Well, I was going to mention chick flicks. You know, there are a certain kind of movies known in the industry as chick flicks that are designed to appeal to women and not designed to appeal to men. And nevertheless, there needs to be social bonding between the spouses, and you have movie night or date night or something, men need to say, maybe not the murder mystery action flick tonight, maybe the romantic comedy, even though I'm not personally interested in that. Now, a husband could frame that to himself as, okay, I need to please my wife, so this is a form of penance. But that would be a kind of negative way, and it could kind of make the wife feel bad.
Yeah.
And so what I would do as a husband, instead of saying that, is I wouldn't even try to think of it that way. I'd say to myself, okay, well, this isn't my thing, but it is my wife's thing, and I want to please her, and I want to be there for her, and I want her to enjoy this. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to do everything I can to help that happen.
Yeah.
And be positive about it. And even, you know, even though I wouldn't watch this movie on my own, you know, look at it and say, what can I appreciate here? You know, did I like that line of dialogue? Did I think the chemistry between this couple was great? You know, did I think the resolution was effective? And I would, even though I might also find things I didn't like, I would zero in on those things that I could praise and talk to my wife afterwards and say, here's what I liked.
Yeah.
And in the same way as a spouse, even if your interest level isn't high, think about your husband's good aspects and look for things you can praise.
Katie, thanks very, very much for that call. We do appreciate it. Do those things that make your husband or wife know that they are loved. That's a big part of being married. And don't worry, Katie, you've been married 2 years. Things also change over time, change and grow. Stay with it, and it gets better and better. We'll be right back after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Dale Alquist of the American Chesterton Society, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Whatever I have learned, writes Catholic Answers founder Carl Keating, I have learned from the masters of the craft. In his new book, Booked for Life, a bibliographic memoir of an accidental apologist, Carl gives future generations a roadmap of what it takes and what it means to become a Catholic apologist. In the way only Carl can, he recounts numerous real-life situations he has encountered in his long career that illustrate the apologetic lessons he's learned. Then, drawing on a lifetime of experience, Carl reveals the books that helped him learn to defend the Catholic faith. Order your copy of Booked for Life today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hello, this is Peggy Normandin, host of Call Me Catholic. Christmas is the definitive season of love. For God so loved the world that he gave us his only begotten Son, the precious baby in the manger. Whatever circumstances we find ourselves in this Christmas, let's dwell in the miracle and the mystery of God's infinite love for us. Let it warm our hearts and nourish our souls. Merry Christmas, my friends, from all of us at EWTN Radio.
Nice job, Darren. The groovy second hour Thursday open forum music. Love that.
I do too. I've got to get a copy of this.
I know. That's Nick Check in the Dead Century and Jimmy Akin, our guest. And boy, you just can't ask for better than that. The groovy music, Jimmy Akin as a guest, and lots of callers on the line.
Cy Kellett as a host and all the other great folks here.
I know. That does make it good, doesn't
including
it?
The callers.
Nicole, we couldn't get through to you last time in Riverside. Are you there with us now?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, thank great.
You. Jimmy?
Go ahead.
Hi, Jimmy. I think you're extraordinary. I wish I had your brain. My question is about the Old Testament, chapter 11.
Okay.
I teach RCIA. I had a candidate ask me a question about the split.
Okay.
When the northern and southern kingdoms split, why did the bulk of the tribes, 10, why did they move north when the temple was in the south? And why would only two go to the south?
Okay, so, well, properly speaking, they didn't move. It's just the northern 10 tribes seceded from the Union, mm-hmm. which is, you know, Middle Eastern politics have always kind of been turned around. So so you, in Israel, you have the north seceding from the south. In terms of why it happened, well, so when Solomon died, his son Rehoboam became king in his stead, and Rehoboam was not a good king. And this was signaled pretty clearly from the beginning of his reign. He had some bad advisors who were kind of young, assertive men like himself, and he didn't listen to the wisdom of his elders. He had a group of older advisors who had advised Solomon and who understood how things worked politically, and he didn't listen to them. Instead, he had these young advisors who said, what you need to do is prove how you're a strong ruler, you're a man, and you need to demonstrate that to everybody in the kingdom. And so what he did was he said, and this is a quote, he said, "Whereas my father laid upon you a heavy yoke, so I shall add tenfold thereto." I'm going to be 10 times harsher than my father. "Whereas my father chastised you with whips, so shall I chastise you with scorpions. For my little finger is thicker than my father's loins, and your backs, which bent like reeds at my father's touch, shall break like straws at my own touch." So he's
a lovely guy.
Yeah. So this is not the way to win friends and influence people. What happened is that, so he's threatening to raise their taxes. That's the yoke.
Yeah.
He's going to dramatically raise their taxes, and he's going to inflict harsh penalties, and he even talks about breaking them.
Yeah.
Well, a bunch of the tribes and a lot of people in the nation of Israel said, "Enough of this." And so the 10 northern tribes, being distant from the capital in Jerusalem in the south, were far enough away that they said, "Guess what? You aren't the king of us anymore." And so they seceded. The southern tribe, Judah, which was Rehoboam's own tribe, well, it was kind of the territory in which Rehoboam lived. And so it's where his power was the strongest. Now, partially because they had a tribal society, there would be an inclination for the Judahites to rally around Rehoboam anyway. So maybe some of them were on board with, "Yeah, we got our strong Judahite king." But other Judahites may have said, "You know, I'm not too wild about this strongman mentality he's got. And maybe if I lived elsewhere, I would secede too." But they lived right there where his power was strongest, and so they couldn't secede even if they wanted to. The Benjaminites, the other southern tribe, it was the same thing with them. And so all of this unfolded as part of God's plan. He allowed this to happen, but he did require the northern Israelites, the 10 northern tribes, to still worship in Jerusalem because that's where he'd put his temple. Mm-hmm. So they were still required to worship down there. Ultimately, a bunch of them didn't. And they set up a rival temple in Samaria on Mount Gerizim. And actually, the ruins of that temple are still there. And the Samaritans today go up there every Passover and slaughter lambs.
Wow.
There's still a few hundred Samaritans. And so they did eventually set up a rival temple, but they weren't supposed to. But that's kind of how all this unfolded. Promises of higher taxes and harsher punishments.
And they still had access to the temple.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though they were in the north. That's where she was confused. So they still had access to the temple.
Absolutely.
And she thought they didn't have access. Okay.
No, they did. Right. And in fact, if you look in the book of Tobit, you'll see – now, Tobit is kind of an extended parable. It's not full history, but it does reflect a lot of historical situations. And one of them is the northern tribes would have devout people who understood they still needed to go down to Jerusalem and worship, and they would do that. And Tobit's father, Tobias, is one of the people who does that. So if you read the book of Tobit, his father, Tobias, actually talks about how he would go down to Jerusalem on the appointed festivals to worship at the temple there.
Nicole, thanks very much for that call. You said that's an RCIA class question?
Yes.
That's kind of, that's cool that you're in RCIA class just really getting into the meat of Scripture. That's a beautiful thing, Nicole. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Anonymous from Indiana now. Anonymous, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I made my first communion 50 years ago, and at that time, we were told not to take communion more than one time in a day,
mm-hmm.
and I don't hear anything about that anymore, so I'm just kind of curious about why that was and if it was still in effect.
Well, I'd have to check the law that governed this at the time. That would have been the 1917 Code of Canon Law. I'd have to check that just to be sure. But what I can tell you about what the state of the law used to be, what I can tell you is what the state of the law is now. In 1983, St. John Paul II promulgated a new Code of Canon Law that replaced the 1917 Code. And in the 1983 Code, it allows for people to receive communion an additional time during the day, provided the second occasion is at a mass. So the first one that they're participating in. So the first one, they don't have to be participating in a mass. It could be a communion service. They could just be walking through a church at communion time but not otherwise participating in the mass. The second time, they need to be attending a mass. There was a question because of the way this canon is worded in the 83 code. There is a question about could they receive just once more a day or more than once a day? And that question was answered after the code was released by the Pontifical Council for Interpretation of Legislative Texts. And they issued an authentic interpretation. What it means is a binding ruling. They issued an authentic interpretation that said, no, it's only once, apart from like danger of death. So under ordinary circumstances, if you're not in danger of death, you can receive communion these days up to twice a day, but the second time needs to be at a mass that you're attending. And the reason why it's only twice presumably is because they don't want to encourage scrupulosity with people thinking, oh, if I go to eight masses a day and receive communion every time, that's going to foster my spiritual development. That's not the way human psychology works. That would – I mean, maybe for somebody that would happen, but for most people, trying to go to eight masses a day and receive communion every time wouldn't actually help them spiritually. So there's a limit to receiving so that it can be in moderation.
Okay, Anonymous.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We go now to Laura in Milpitas, California, listening on Ave Maria Radio online. Laura, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. Someone asked me this question,
okay.
And I came up with an answer, but I wanted to
check it out.
Get someone else's take, yes.
Okay.
A more intelligent response, hopefully, than mine.
Who knows?
Somebody asked.
And I say who knows because it's great to hear from Milpitas, home of the Milpitas Monster, very famous schlock horror movie from I think the 70s. And so I don't know that I can guarantee a more intelligent response, given that I'm a fan of schlock movies like Milpitas Monster.
Are you familiar with that movie, Laura?
I'm impressed. You've even heard of it. Yes. The question is, if our bodies are perfected when in our glorified bodies, we won't have the frailties or injuries or so forth, why did Christ's glorified body after his resurrection still have the wounds?
Uh-huh.
And then I have a follow-up to that.
Okay, what's the follow-up? And I'll address them both together.
It sort of depends on what your answer
okay.
to that is.
Well, let me answer the first one.
Okay.
So Jesus obviously didn't have his body in exactly the same state as it was on the cross. I mean, he didn't have he did have nail marks and so forth and have wounds in that sense, but they weren't like gushing blood. You know, he wasn't having active blood loss. So obviously there is a difference after the resurrection than before. The way I would look at it, because we are presented with a depiction of the next life as being a glorious, perfect one, what I would say is that in all likelihood, we're going to be able to, and Jesus in particular, being God and being imbued with supernatural power, was able to control whether he manifested with wounds or not. And an example, perhaps, of that is when he appears on the road to Emmaus. And the two guys he's walking with, not only, I mean, they don't notice he's Jesus, they presumably, therefore, didn't also notice that he had wounds. Now, you can kind of debate, well, why didn't they recognize him? A theory that I find intriguing, so I'm kind of partial to it, is that he looked the same as he always did, except they were kept from recognizing him because there's a circuit in our brains that enables us to recognize faces. And in some people, that circuit gets broken and they have what's called face blindness or prosopagnosia, where they can't recognize faces. And so I kind of like the idea of maybe by divine, you know, God kind of put his finger down in their brains and kept that circuit from working for a time so they didn't recognize Jesus. And then when they're breaking bread, he like lets the circuit go back to its normal function and suddenly they realize it's Jesus. That's one possibility, but it could be he appeared in a totally different form to them. So he looked like a different person. And if that was the case, presumably he didn't have the wounds of crucifixion manifesting. Either way, given he's omnipotent, I think he had certainly the ability to either manifest the wounds or not manifest the wounds as the occasion demanded. And I would suppose the same thing is going to be the case for us, because we're told that what we're going to be like hasn't been revealed, but we know we're going to be like Jesus, for we will see him as he is. So we may have a similar power with our glorified bodies to manifest in different ways, perhaps like we were at different ages in life, or with or without bodily defects we may have had in life. That would be my guess.
Laura, does that address your follow-up as well, or did?
I think it does, because the follow-up was regarding, martyrs, perhaps who had been killed sometimes. Horrible ways.
Right. Like, so if someone's dismembered, you're not going to be dismembered in the resurrection. I guess you could, if you chose and it was appropriate, you could manifest in a dismembered form, but that's not going to be a situation you're stuck with all the time.
Laura, we got to go to a break, but thank you very, very much for that question. We'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Just like the saints of the Counter-Reformation, our own souls are in constant need of reform, of reconversion to God and His will for us. We struggle with sin. We become distracted in prayer. We find it hard to be loving and easy to be selfish. In Reform Yourself, Sean McAfee shows you how these magnificent saints can be guides to your own personal transformation. We all need to reform our souls. Let the saints who reformed the church show you how. Order your copy of Reform Yourself today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Matthew 2:13, King Herod, furious at being deceived by the astrologers, ordered the massacre of all little boys of 2 years and younger in Bethlehem and its surroundings. We have come to call these children the Holy Innocents. Today we honor them as saints. Often people ask if a baby that dies without being baptized will go to heaven. The Catechism of the Catholic Church recalls that God desires that all be saved, and also the great love Jesus had for children. Such allows us to hope that such children are at home in heaven. It is also good to note that the Holy Innocents were not, technically speaking, martyrs. They had no choice in the matter. They certainly were not baptized, and we still recognize that they are in heaven. May the thousands of innocents who are the victims of abortion be among them. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Hope you're having a very blessed and merry Christmas season at your house. I am Cy Kellett, your host. This is Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum today, meaning we're pretty much willing to take any question you got. Jimmy Akin is here to answer your questions. Jimmy, the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, which is on sale now at 30% off at shop.catholic.com. And Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Let's go now to Tim in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Tom. No,
excuse me, Tom in New Orleans. Listening.
It's okay. Hebrew doesn't have any vowels written.
Oh, really? So Tim and Tom would be the same name?
Well, they could use either a yod or a vav as a mater lectionis.
I was going to say that.
Yeah.
I was right on the verge of saying that.
Okay.
Mavs and yovs, I'd never know which one to use. Tom, listening 690 a.m. in Louisiana, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, hello.
Howdy. You're on the air, Tom. What's your question?
I was listening to Catholic radio here, and the program was called Encounter.
Okay, I haven't heard that show. I don't know anything about it, but if you can give me a question, I'll be happy to take a swing at it.
Okay, well, the problem was that the young man who had been raised by a good Catholic family and nurtured in all the
things a Catholic should be nurtured
ways
in
to be a good Catholic. And
what happened?
He went to school and they had a mass at that school.
Mm-hmm.
And he was afraid of standing up when the priest asked a certain question of the congregation.
Okay.
And I would call that peer pressure. And how does the Catholic Church address the concept of the fear of man, and what do they do to alleviate it? Since this young man was fortified by a good Catholic family.
Okay.
Yet he succumbed to peer pressure.
Okay. Well, I would say a number of things. First one is it is natural for us to look out for our interests. Self-interest is a reasonable thing, and God built self-interest into us. So we are by divine law required to look out for our own good, at least under ordinary affairs, under ordinary situations. There can be situations where we need to put somebody else's good above ours, but on balance, we need to look out for our good first and the good of those who are connected to us, like our spouses and children. And that self-interest is something that's there by divine nature, and it's honorable and it's fine. Jesus even appeals to it when he says, "What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world but loses his soul?" So Jesus right there appeals to self-interest. So self-interest is okay. Now, having said that, sometimes, one of the things that can interfere with our self-interest is having people think ill of us. And so if we thought that, okay, I'm in a social public situation and somebody has just said, okay, everybody stand up who has ever done something bad, and they may name what the bad thing is. Well, if we stand up at that point, other people could look at us and say, ooh, that guy did this bad thing. I'm going to think less of him. And that harms his self-interest. And so under ordinary circumstances, I would say you don't have any obligation to reveal that. I mean, a priest may invite you to, but you're not in the sacrament of confession. You're not obligated to damage your reputation publicly. It's none of the priest's business. And frankly, I would even question – now, I don't know that this was the question he's asking. I'm just trying to imagine what he might have asked. But if the priest said, okay, everybody who's a smoker, stand up, or everyone who's ever gotten drunk, stand up, or everyone who's ever committed a sexual sin, get up. Well, those are things, frankly, some of them, like smoking, isn't even actually a sin, but it is something that's often frowned upon in our culture. And other things like getting drunk or having committing a sexual sin, that's none of anybody's business. And so I would say this gentleman, even though he might have articulated it in terms of, I was afraid, I didn't want to admit this in public, he was perfectly entitled to stay seated because this isn't a legitimate request for a priest to make. So I would – and now you might frame that in terms of this was peer pressure that kept him seated. But peer pressure can be a legitimate thing. It actually plays a useful role in our society. It helps people do the things they need to do because if people had no respect for the views of their peers, if they just totally didn't take other people's views into account, they'd do a lot more bad stuff. And so, quote unquote, peer pressure, even though it gets a bad rap, the way people talk about it, it actually can play a very useful role. And so I would say what we need to do is distinguish between when peer pressure is playing a useful role and when it's not. And when it's not, then people do need to resist peer pressure. Let's say you're a young person, your friends are trying to tempt you into getting drunk or taking drugs. Well, that's when you need – they're tempting you not to do something good. They're pressuring you not to do something good but to do something bad. And so that's when you need to resist the peer pressure. And I really – if someone's experiencing fear in that regard, I would say what you always hear when someone's experiencing fear, let's say in a battle situation, bravery doesn't mean not feeling the emotion. It means doing the right thing irrespective of the emotion. So just relax and do the right thing and don't worry about your feelings. So if peer pressure is being put on you to do something bad, it's understandable. You would fear that these people may think less of me or, you know, that might harm me in some way. That's an understandable fear. Maybe it's a realistic fear, maybe it's not, but it's understandable that you have that. If you know the right thing to do, though, then what you need to do is ignore the feeling, try to put it out of your mind, and just do the right thing. And that's the advice that any competent spiritual advisor, whether Catholic or otherwise, would give somebody dealing with peer pressure to do something wrong.
Tom, thank you very much for that call. Let's see if we can get another call in here real quick before we have to end for the day. Anonymous, you are on. If you could phrase your question quickly, it'll give Jimmy a chance to answer you.
Sure. Hi, Jimmy. Hi, Si.
Hi.
I've been dealing with a sexual mortal sin ever since I was a child.
Okay.
And figured out what I could use a computer for, but I'm in my 20s now and didn't realize it was a mortal sin until probably 4 months ago when God put it into my mind and I confessed it for the first time at that 4 month mark. And since then, you know, I've been really trying to stop by putting controls in place on my computer and phone and have an accountability partner, trying to become more faithful, but I'm struggling and I can override these controls that I put in place. I've confessed this.
Anonymous, just so you know, we're right at the end of the show. What's your question so I can help?
Okay. Yeah. So, is it considered sacrilege with abusing the sacrament by confessing the sin multiple times, more than 10? Okay. And what is your opinion, and if you have any recommendations on like an anonymous group?
Sure.
All right.
So given the brief time we have, I'll be of all the assistance I can. It is not sacrilegious to confess a sin repeatedly. In order for it to be a sacrilege, you have to have no intent of doing better. Even if you foresee, and this is something that's talked about in the Vademecum for Confessors, which you can look up, Vademecum for Confessors, if you intend to do better by God's grace, that's sufficient. Even if you foresee that you're likely to fall again in the future, as long as right now you don't want this in your life, you've set your will against it, that's enough for the confession to be valid. It won't be sacrilegious.
Thank you very much, Anonymous, for that call. Thanks, everybody, for your calls. And I'd even add this. Thanks for a really wonderful time in the year 2017 on Catholic Answers Live. So many great calls. So many wonderful opportunities to interact with people. Jimmy Akin, thank you.
Thank you. Happy New Year, Cy, and to everybody else.
And Happy New Year to you. I couldn't be happier to be ending the year here at Catholic Answers with you on the air. And I get to say this one more time before the year is over. Jesus Christ is the light of the nations. And we'll see you next time on Catholic Answers Live.